everybody. My name is Al Marinone. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, that sounds good. I've been sober now 43 years. I'm up next month. Of course, I came into AA when I was 10 years old. Well, this is a nice crowd. This is great. This is wonderful. We'll get out of here about midnight now. When I see a crowd like that, I can't just... I can't just stop. Now, I come from a little town in North Idaho, which is, Spokane, Washington is 30 miles west of us. And we're west... We're 30 miles east of Spokane. It's called Coeur d'Alene, on a Coeur d'Alene Lake. It's one of the most beautiful spots in all the world. But it's too damn cold. I had to get out. Well, they had a kind of a homecoming for me in this little town. It's 20,000 population. They had a big breakfast there in my honor, the Alcoholics Anonymous. And they put out flyers all over. They came from Canada and all over, and they couldn't get them all in this place where they had this big breakfast. But it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. I tell you, it really touched my heart, an emotional old goat like I am. But about a month after I was there, I got a letter from a friend of mine and from Coeur d'Alene. And this was dated Tuesday, October the 25th, 1983. And it says, "The North Idaho Album from the files of the Coeur d'Alene Press." It says, 50 years ago, Al Marino, a Lake City boy who had achieved fame as a radio performer in the Midwest, literally sang his way out of the Spokane traffic court. The Coeur d'Alene Press reported that the boy, after being acquitted of a traffic offense, was asked by the prosecutor to sing for the judge. The boy responded with a few verses of "There's a Light in Your Eyes, Sweetheart Darling." and left the courtroom mid great applause. My first drunk driving charge, and I sang my way out of court. Not bad, huh? Those were wonderful, wonderful days. You know, I did my big drinking long before most of you were born, back in the 30s. I was a musician most of my life. 40 years I played slide trombone. And that's how I happened to come to California and Los Angeles and Hollywood, where I played for pictures. I had a very wonderful rating as a trombone player, one of the four best in the world at that time. You see, that was very bad for a drunk. The old ego, the head expanded a little bit, you know, and I just drank that much more when that came out in the Metronome magazine many years ago. But back in the 30s, we didn't have anywhere to turn because alcoholism was not recognized as a disease. And the American Medical Association did not recognize it as a disease. Therefore, the doctors didn't pay much attention to us, and the hospitals wouldn't accept an alcoholic. Oh, I remember a couple of times in my early days in AA, when guys were having alcoholic convulsions and there was a sure sense to die, I took them down to the county hospital and dumped them off at the rear door, and they had to take them in and save their lives. And that's how bad it was in those days. All they did with us drunks then was throw us in the can, put us out on the highways out in the county, building roads, and put you in the nut house. The Camarilla was loaded with alcoholics. And this is the way it was then. It was pretty bad. We all went through the same thing. And then in 1941, Alcoholics Anonymous came along for me. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a 100% guarantee that I would never drink again if I lived according to certain conditions as honest as I possibly could. Alcoholics Anonymous gave us all a 100% guarantee that we would never drink again if we lived according to certain conditions, which are the simple 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as honest as we possibly could. And most of us say, I haven't the ability to be honest anymore. But it says in the book, the willingness to try to be honest alone will do the job. And I keep accenting the word honesty. And basically, that's the thing that gets us here, and that's the thing that keeps us sober, honesty. Do you honestly want to stay sober? Will you honestly go to any length to stay sober? And we who honestly wanted to stay sober thought we'd take a flyer at this thing, although there was nobody with a bunch of needles or anybody giving us a lot of wacky-doodle advice. We tried to live according to these steps to the best of our ability. And miracles happened. Our family and our friends noticed long before we realized that there's been a definite change in our attitude towards ourselves, in fact, in a great change in our personality. Although slight, we stayed sober. Although the change was slight, we stayed sober. And this is a miracle. You're looking at a miracle up here tonight. A miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we are all miracles who stay sober on Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, there's only one thing that can cause a miracle, and that's some power greater than ourselves. Some call it God, some call it Muhammad, some call it anything that they desire. But because we are a miracle, that's the only thing that can keep us sober, is some power greater than ourselves. And you see, they told us it was our stinking thinking that caused our drinking. And maybe we're reversing that stinking thinking a little bit by living these 12 steps to the best of our ability. And then Bill Wilson, in his wisdom, when he wrote this book, wrote those three pertinent ideas at the end of the steps. He said, A, I am an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. And B, that probably no human power could help me. And with me, it wasn't probably, no human power could help me. I tried them all. And C, that God could and would, if sought. Well, I was sober 4, 5 years. And I said to Bill Wilson when he was out in Los Angeles, I says, these things are beautiful, but God could and would have sought. How am I seeking God? I am sober. He says, you're living the program, aren't you? I says, the best of my ability. Well, he says, it so happens that these steps are spiritual steps. And anything that is good and positive is a spiritual thing. Therefore, you are trying to live a spiritual life, whether you realize it or not. So it all comes together. It all comes together on 2 pages in our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. God could and would have sought, and if I live these steps to the best of my ability, I'm actually trying to live a spiritual life because these steps are spiritual. Therefore, I'm getting the help of God as I understand Him. And everybody has their own opinion of God or who it is or what it is. It's not a human power. I happen to have a little nephew who is a Jesuit priest. And I says, Joe, who's God? Well, he says, God is anything that you believe in outside of a human power. He says, we have a great deal of Indian blood in us. What's the matter with the Great Spirit? I says, fine. So the Great Spirit is my God. And it works very good. They all work very good because they're not a human power. And this is the basis of my sobriety. Do what I'm supposed to do when I'm supposed to do it, and God will take care of the rest. That you just use a little bit of basic honesty. And this is the program, and if I go no further, I have told you how I am staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. 43 years, it'll be 43 years next month. Oh, we have to jump a month once in a while, you know. What the hell? When I came into Los Angeles, into AA in Los Angeles back in 41, there were just 34 members west of the Rockies. AA had started in Los Angeles about a year before, but it fell to pieces. Everybody got to fighting and one thing or another, you know. And they had a non-alcoholic woman from New York came there with a book. And no non-alcoholic woman can keep drunk sober, you know that. And she had an absolute failure. So a little fellow by the name of Mortimer J. came in from Denver, Colorado. And a little Mortimer J. came out there because he got on a big drunk and he left Denver. He came from a very wealthy family in Denver, and he left Denver and started for Los Angeles, and it took him 6 weeks to make it. He says, I was in Mexico when I was here and there. He says, I hardly remember where the hell it was. So he went down to Palm Springs to sober up. And when he got down to Palm Springs, of course, he just stayed drunk. And this Sunday morning, he woke up and, oh, it was terrible. He had the whoops and jingles and he was seeing things and he was in a hell of a shape and he had to have a drink. And he couldn't get a drink until 10 o'clock that morning, something like it. And he said, so he grabbed a suitcase and he started going through his luggage, and here he ran into this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that he had had. He read it one time when he was drunk, but he threw it back in there and he hadn't read it for years, for a long, long time, years that he's just been out of it here. So he said that he sat down and started reading this book when he was trying to get over those jitters and whoops and jingles. And he says, my God, I read it from one end to the other and I haven't had a drink since. That's what you call a sudden spiritual awakening of some kind, you know. You know, there's just about one out of every 10,000 has a sudden spiritual awakening, you know. So don't wait for it. Actually, our change in our attitudes and our personality is truly the spiritual awakening, as you know. It's a gradual thing, but it's there for good. It's there for all time. Well, anyway, he came up to Los Angeles, and he floundered around up there and tried to get in a couple of groups, and one of them had a group, but that wasn't true Alcoholics Anonymous. They had a study group on alcoholism, a bunch of those high bottoms, you know, over in Pasadena. And so he wanted to bring another guy over the following week, and they said they had a vote on it to get permission to bring somebody else. So he says, that can't be Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said that we didn't say it was. So he started a group at the Cecil Hotel downtown. That was way back in 40. Well, he got that up to eight members. And he's going along pretty good. And he's paying for the room and the whole deal. And one Friday night, it was a Friday night meeting, he got down there and there were two out of the eight that weren't there. So he sent two over to pick him up and bring him over to the apartment. And they didn't come back. So he sent the other four over to get that four. And nobody came back. And he ended up reading the steps to himself, you know. So he finally kept on working, and he started this group going again. And when I came in, why, Mort was the founder, Mort J. We call him the Bill Wilson of the West Coast. They had the book. They didn't have anybody from New York to guide us, thank God. So Mort said one night, he said, I think we ought to have a format for this meeting so that we'll be sure that everything works out just fine. So Mort suggested that we read a portion of Chapter 5 and the 12 Steps, which was done. And then there was some ding-dong in the back row. You see, we had about 34 people there, and there were just four of us less than 40 years old. All the rest of them were old goats, and they were mean old goats, too. And the one girl, Sybil, was the only girl there. And he suggested that this guy in the back row suggested we recite the Lord's Prayer. And my God, you never heard such a rumble in your life. I mean, everybody went crazy. What do you want, another religion? Quack, 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 and win. And a couple of them got in a big fight in the back row, and one guy hit the other guy over the head with a chair, and I said, wonderful. I'm coming back. I like this, you know. So they voted on it, and they voted in the Lord's Prayer. Now, all over the world, and I've been all over the world, as far as Singapore, and all over, and they use our format for the meetings. Reading of the steps and portion of Chapter 5, and they end up with the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. I voted against it because I was afraid we were getting into that cult business, you know. In fact, I was afraid we were going into the cult business for a long time. Oh, we had wonderful times. Fights, wonderful. Just wonderful. And then there was, you know what we did one time? There was one guy there who started another group, and he was going to take over, and so we incorporated AA in the state of California. And you know, nobody could start a group unless they got our permission. And we had them dead to rights, you know. But we still had a few brains in the group, and they talked us out of it, you know. So they let us slide. It was a crazy thing. They had a guy at the door. And when a new person would come to the door, they'd say, do you want to stay sober on an all-time basis? And if you hesitate a little bit, they say, get the hell out of here and make up your mind. No hesitation with them, you know. We got the true alcoholics, so our percentage of sobriety was very high, very high. A couple of the members of the group used to get drunk on us once in a while, and they'd go to some bar, and they'd get drunk, and they'd tell everybody in the joint they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were ruining our reputation. So we had a meeting of the steering committee, and we're going to deal with this thing. So this thing went on and on and on and on, and finally we voted. We voted, and we laid down a law. Anybody that get drunk twice can't come to AA no more. He's through for life. We're going to fix those guys up real good, believe me. Well, the following Friday night when we had a regular meeting, one of our good members who had some brains left, he got up for the group and he says, "Now, we always used to go to the book for all our answers. All your answers are in the book if you want to look for them." And he got up there and he says, "I've studied the book and I've studied the book and I can't find out anywhere in the book where we have a right to bar anybody from AA. It says in the book anybody with an alcoholic problem is welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." So we had to let those bastards back in. The group grew to be very large, over to a hall at 2200 West 7th Street, which was just across the park, MacArthur Park. And this is a great, big, beautiful hall, possibly about the size of this one. They had a great big kitchen, and it was owned by a Jewish fellow that held this for the Jewish Kazatskas. This was a sort of a headquarters they had there, and upstairs they had several rooms. And we went over and asked if he would let us meet there on Friday nights. We told him we were Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says, "I'll let you know." And he thought, "Geez, with alcohol in it, you know, they might wreck the joint." We would have. We'd have been drunk, most likely. So we went back about a week later, and he gave us permission to use his hall and use the ones upstairs, and he set a price. His name was Farber, and I would say that Mr. Farber was just about as responsible as anybody for the success of Alcoholics Anonymous west of the Rockies. He allowed us to stay there when we were really had it tough financially. You can imagine in those days, everybody was broke flat on a fanny. And we met in this hall, and the group grew very, very fast, and the group to be a great big group. We had about 600 members, and they came in from Santa Barbara, Bakersfield, San Bernardino, and all down the coast. They came to this one great big meeting on Friday nights. And now the women started to come on in. My God, I don't know where they got it, but they come out from under the rocks, and they were falling out of trees. You never saw so many broads in your life. It was wonderful. It was just wonderful, you know. Then we had this first meeting was an open meeting from 8:30 to 9:30, and then from 10 on, why, was the alcoholic meeting, and the non-alcoholics went upstairs and they started a group of their own. And my wife, God bless her, was one of these that was participating in this non-alcoholic meeting, and they called it the Non-Alcoholic Family Group. And this was the forerunner for Al-Anon. And this is where Al-Anon started, right there at 2200 West 7th, because Bill and Lois came out. In fact, they came out there two or three times. And Bill got a load of it, and he brought Lois up there, and they saw what was going on, and they took all the ideas back to New York with our permission and changed the name to Al-Anon. And my wife was one of the founders of this thing. But she won't even go and read the steps for them anymore. She says, "It's all politics. I want no part of it." And if you knew her, she means it, you know. I'm going to trade her in for a new model any day now, you know. Nah, she's the greatest gal in the world, just the greatest. Hadn't it been for her, I'd have been dead now. Anyway, we had it going real good, and at the end of the second meeting, we never had any closing time. Now they say there's no soul saved after 10 o'clock. That's a damn lie. You can save many time. You can just save many time, you know. So sometimes when you got up to speak at that group, you in your hands. You know, you start saying, telling them how rough it was and how things were bad, and everybody in the audience start going, boo, and they take out their handkerchiefs and blow their nose. I mean, it was awful. You just embarrassed the hell out of you. So when you spoke there, you had to be steeled up in pretty good shape. You needed to drink is what you needed. Then after the meeting, we would have coffee and donuts, and we had a whole bunch of long tables in this room, and we'd all cluster around there and have our donuts and coffee and sit there and chat. And this was the social part of the evening, and this is the part of the evening that I really missed after that thing broke up. It was just beautiful. We'd stay there till 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. It was wonderful. You know, every Friday night was New Year's Eve for us there. Every Friday night was New Year's Eve, and we looked forward to it. And I mean, we really looked forward to it. It was wonderful. And then, of course, things had to get bad. The war came along, about 42 along in there. And all our friends from Santa Barbara and Bakersfield and all the outlying areas couldn't get into town on account of gas. Gasoline shortage, as you know. You old goats, I see a few gray hairs out there. You remember when we were had it so tough for gasoline, so all these people had to start groups in their own neighborhood. So we encouraged everybody to start groups around town, and now they got 1,000 groups in Los Angeles County. They got so damn many meetings, you can fall out of your back door and walk 2 blocks, and you're in a meeting. That's how they got too damn many. I can't keep control of them anymore. They're just too many. Well, that was the end of that beautiful thing. It ran along for quite a few years, the old mother group, and it gradually died out. But that's where we started from. That's where everything was hooked up and arranged right at that meeting. And I started a group called the Arlington Group out near where I lived on Arlington Boulevard. Now we're 38 years old. And we have a meeting Tuesday and Thursday night. And Tuesdays we have about 300 members and people. And on Thursday night we have about 200. And we're doing a good job. We figured out the other day there's over 20,000 newcomers have come through that door since we started at this particular place. And we've been in one place there for 30 years called the Arlington Group. And I think we're doing a job. I think we're doing a job for these people. If just half of those 20,000 stay sober, we've done a hell of a job. If 25% stay sober, we've done a hell of a job. Because a group is nothing more than doing 12-step work. Like an individual does 12-step work, the group does 12-step work. And I think it's very important for us to keep that in mind. Get that new person and give them a good indoctrination when they come to a meeting, so they'll be sure to come back. And that's the way it was. Now, I am a trombone player, and I came to Los Angeles in 1934. I'm from the West, but I finally ended up in Chicago. And I had a wife and 2 kids. And I had maybe the most intolerant wife that God ever put on earth. She would get all upset if I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days. One of those silly people. Us guys were working a picture and do a picture, and I mean, our nerves were just at edge, you know, after working for a week or two on one picture. So we'd go down to Tijuana and pin on a nice little drunk, you know, a half a dozen of us. And my wife, she was very intolerant. She didn't like this. She just raised hell. And then it got so bad, when I was away for a few days, I'd come home and here'd be divorce papers all over the house. I mean, this is intolerance of the nth degree. After all, I was feeding them and paying the rent. The silliest person I ever saw in my life. You know, all I wanted was somebody to hold my head while I puked, you know, and and sympathize with me. But it got worse and worse and worse and worse. Across the street was another alcoholic musician by the name of Jack. And old Jack was one of the most brilliant musicians I ever met in my life. He had perfect pitch. He could write, he could arrange, he could compose, he could play all the reed instruments beautifully, and he was the worst drunk I ever saw in my life. He was a psychopathic drunk, you know. He would stay in bed for days just drinking and never get out of that damn pad. I never saw anything like that. I says, how do you get any fun out of it? Well, he says, I don't get much fun, but I don't get pinched either. Of course, I was getting pinched all the time. So old Jack and I, we organized an AA group all our own, long before you people came on the scene. We had it all tapped down. It was a matter of one alcoholic helping the other. If I had a date at the studio, say at 10 o'clock, about 7 o'clock in the morning, I'd wake up with a hangover you could cut with a knife, and I'd be sick, and I'd have the shakes, and I'd call across the street to Jack, and I'd say, Jack, make the run, or get a jug, or whatever it was. And in due time, Jack would get over there with a jug, and I'd get well. And by the same token, I did exactly the same thing for Jack, one alcoholic helping the other. Where two or more are gathered together. Down around the corner on Beverly Boulevard was a liquor store, off-sale liquor store. Old Sam Cohen had maybe one of the nicest liquor stores I ever saw in my life. So being a smart alcoholic, I'm going to set myself up a charge account, which we called a cuff. So I got him cuffed up to 2 jugs, and old Sam wouldn't cuff for any more. So I told Jack, I says, old Sam is a tough guy. I got him cuffed up to 2 jugs, and he won't cuff for any more. He says, most likely you don't treat him right. He says, you don't know how to talk to him. And I says, oh, yes, I'm a pretty smart sailor. He says, you know, He says, maybe he says he's a little reticent because he says, I owe him $500. I says, how the hell did you get him to $500? He says, by using my head, dum-dum. He says, I owed him 40, I paid him 20. I paid him 60, I owed him, paid him 30. I owed him 80, I paid him 40. I owed him 100, I paid him 50. Of course, it took me quite a while, but I got him up to 500. I says, you're an absolute genius, that's all. He says, I know it. So one day we're both dying for a drink, and he says, let's see Sam. And I says, oh, you get it. Sam isn't going to give us a jug. And he says, watch me work. And he says, Sam, give me a jug of so-and-so. And Sam says, I can't do it, Jack. He says, you owe me $500, and I need it right now. And if I don't get it, I'm going bankrupt. I have to have that dough. And they yak back and forth and yak and forth. Finally, old Sam made the worst mistake of his life. He says, go down to the bank and borrow it. And Jack says, you mean on a personal note? And Sam says, yeah. Well, he says, I need a cosigner on that note, Sam. And Sam says, I'll cosign. We got our job. Go to any lengths to get it. Long about this time, of course, things are getting very, very ratty. I had a lot of friends in the studios, and of course, there's politics in that department, too. And they were getting a little disgusted with me because sometimes I'd come to work and I wouldn't play very well. The goddamn horn would just shake all over my face. It was awful. Not that I went to work drunk. It was with the hangovers that was the bad part. So it was the toughest music in the world, there's no doubt. And so my family and my friends got together, and they just raised hell with me. And finally, I took a cure. It was called the Halco cure. And it was an aversion treatment, you know. And they charged $150. And I called them up, and I had a big picture coming up the following week, and I had to get in shape. So they were there in no time and took me out. It was out in Culver City, called the Halco cure. And the doctor checked me out and says, your heart's good, your blood pressure's good. He says, you're fine. And I'm standing there shaking. I says, what are you going to do, doctor? And he says, oh, just give you the cure. Just give you the cure. So they took all my clothes away from me and gave me one of those little short nightgowns, you know. Those little cutie things just barely, you know, they get on there. And they put me to bed. And my God, there was four nurses standing out there, two male and two female. And one of the guys come dancing in with a jug, and he got to fill the glass with booze, and they held up my head, and they threw that booze down me, and they gave me five or six of those glasses. My God, I'm drunker than a goat again. You know, this is fine. You know, this is fine. Then they hit me in the chest with that stuff called apomorphine and a great big needle, a big horse pistol. And I got so sick, I never was so sick in my life. My head went over the side of the bed, and I never puked so... My eyeballs dropped. My eyeballs dropped out and were running around on the floor. It was so bad. Everything in me was going out. It was awful. And then when I was just getting my breath, they took me in another room and they gave me 5,000 high enemas on top of all this. And I run like a scared deer when you say enema to me now. Then they put me back to bed and they gave me something to perspire, and I soaked right through the mattress. And this was just one treatment. And I got one of these every 4 hours for 3 days and three nights. And baby, when I got out of that joint, I was as pure as the day I was born. And I paid $150 for that. And I was drunk in a week. And you see, I couldn't go to a doctor. I couldn't go to a hospital. I mean, veterans' hospitals, no one would have anything to do with you. They wouldn't have anything to do with you because American Medical Association said that we did not have as a disease, that we were just weak-willed bums. And then along about 1949 or 1950, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who was a senator, oh, we got big ones, you know, they're members of AA now, and Betty, you know Betty, and I spoke at her joint down there in Palm Desert the other day. Anyway, this guy got up before Congress, and he got a bill through, whereby Congress would put out, I mean, the U.S. government would put out $350 million a year for the rehabilitation of alcoholics. And do you know, the American Medical Association, the next day after this bill was passed, decided that alcoholism was a disease. Do you get that? They said that now that they're going to get money for it, we'll declare it's a disease, you see. I think that's funny as hell. Nobody laughs at it, do they? So anyway, that's the way it was in those days. Friends of mine were committing suicide. It was really terrible, terrible. You know, I quit drinking before vodka became popular. I have never had a drink of vodka. Isn't that awful? I have smelled a lot of it. And they sell you don't smell a guy's breath when he's been drinking vodka. My God, it smells like puke to me. Rotten potatoes or something. So I don't think I missed much. And then my family and my friends and everybody decided, of course, this is over a matter of years, that I should have psychiatric treatment. So they got a psychiatrist for me, and he was a very fine psychiatrist because he spoke broken English. He must have been good, see? He couldn't speak English. He was from Europe. His name you couldn't pronounce. So we had 3 seances together, this guy and I. And I'm sober at the time, so he said, you're of a superior intelligence. And I said, well, thank you. He says, you need this psychiatric treatment like a hole in your head. He says, I don't think that you should come here and spend your money for treatments. And I says, that's just fine. So I had to laugh on all my friends and my family. It was like old John. Old John lived in this town, medium-sized city. Old John, he was about 40 years old. And he was drunk all the time. And he come from one of the finest families in town. Well-known, fine families. All alcoholics come from fine families. Did you know that? You know, it's a funny thing. The guy's walking down the street and hitting both sides of the sidewalk, and all these biddies are standing there and saying, and look at him, and look at him, and he comes from such a fine family. So John's family got him to go to this psychiatrist. So he went to the psychiatrist and took treatment after treatment and seance after seance, and he just stayed drunk. So finally, he came this day, and the psychiatrist says, John, we're going to change the method. We're not having any success the other way. And he says, all I want you to do is answer my questions honestly. And John says, okay. He says, now what would happen to you if I cut off your left ear? And John says, my hearing would be impaired about 50%. He says, now we're getting somewhere. And I says, what would happen to you if I cut off your right ear? And John says, I wouldn't be able to see. He says, why wouldn't you be able to see? He says, my hat would fall down over my eyes. And you see, Les, they're still good. So like all alcoholics of my breed and my era, I ended up with a religious ankle. Now, a lot of drunks went to the religious ankle due to the fact that, they were sinners, they were this, they were that, which we find out is very much of a fallacy. And some of them should have never got mixed up with the religion because they got as nuts on the religion as they did the alcohol. You know, they're out on the corner beating a drum. So we moved up to a little town called Tahunga, about 30 miles up from Hollywood, and my oldest daughter had asthma. So we moved up there, and I got acquainted with an old priest up there by the name of Dennis Falvey, Father Dennis Falvey from Ireland, and a wonderful old guy. And I had been raised a Catholic, but hadn't been to church for some 20 years. It always tickles me when they say, you are a fallen away Catholic. Quack, 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 you know. But old Dennis and I, we got along fine. He was a great salesman. He got me to put a nice little organ in the church, and we got a little choir together, and I conducted the choir, and I used to play trombone solos while I took up the collection. And big, big deal, but I didn't show up every Sunday. I was out maybe on a drunk or something. Usually on Monday morning, I'd be at Father's back door saying, Dennis, loan me $5 so I can get off of this drunk. And he'd always say, here you are, my boy, but don't spend it all in one place. Not once did he say, why don't you quit drinking? Not once did he say that. And I thought, well, maybe he had been a drunk and he quit and he knew just what I was going through. Of course, I always paid him his $5 back. So this time, things were very bad around Christmas, and I got myself on an awful drunk, and I smashed up a brand new car. I got thrown in the county jail. And I'm supposed to be down at High Mass Christmas morning at 8 o'clock conducting a choir. You know, we drunks always get drunk at the wrong time. Now, I had been sober a whole month that time, a whole month. And so here I am in a county jail Christmas morning. I called up a lawyer friend of mine who had been a musician that I worked with, and now he's a lawyer, and his name was Bunny Cohen. And I says, Bunny, come down and get me out. I got a drunk driving charge. Get me out of this can quick as fast. He says, I'll be right down. He didn't get there till 9:30 Christmas night. And I says, where the hell have you been? He says, I was drunk myself, and I had to sober up or they'd have put me in with you. Don't ever get thrown in the can on Christmas Eve, because Christmas morning, They're out there right outside of your cell singing those hymns, and you want to kill yourself anyway, you know. Oh, God, what a feeling. What a feeling. It was awful. So jumping over all the other things that happened, I went down and I said, "Dennis, I guess I'd better take the pledge." He says, "You can take the pledge if you want to, but it won't do you any good." And I says, "What do you mean it won't do me any good? I mean, I got as much faith as anybody else." And he says, "Oh, yeah, but you're one of those guys." I says, "What do you mean one of those guys?" And he says, "There's no hopes for it. Nothing can help you." I says, "Well, did you ever know one of those guys who ever got sober and stayed sober?" And he says, "Once in my life. I had a little church in South Dakota, and there was one of the local drunks there who was the worst drunk in town. And he says, one morning he woke up, and he was absolutely a different personality, on the plus side. And he never took another drink, and we all loved this little guy and made him my mayor eventually. And he had what we call a sudden spiritual awakening. But he didn't know what it was. And I says, let's get this guy and find out what the cause of this change in his personality was. He says, oh, I don't even remember the town right now if you want to know it. All I can do is pray that we can find out the reason that this guy had this terrific change. So I says, well, what's going to happen to me? And he says, you're going to die. You're going to die in the gutter. I said, are you kidding? What are you talking about? He said, no, I'm telling you honestly. Every man of your type that I've ever known ends up in the gutter, and they're dead. So I says, thank you. And I started walking away. And he says, just a minute, I want to tell you something. He says, Al, it's not a sin to drink. It's not a moral vice to drink. But it's a sin to be a glutton. And that's as much as I can help you. And that's as much as any honest man of the cloth can help you. So I went my way. And God in his kindness was good to me. My wife got a divorce. And now things are really bad. Now I have been a failure in my life, and now I'm a failure in marriage, and everything is upside down. But I didn't realize at the time that this is all God's will and this is the way it should have been. And I went back to Hollywood, of course. And within a short few years, I had drunk myself out of everything, and I'm down the tubes for fair. And I ended up down on the south side of Los Angeles at Venice and Arlington, in a $2 a week room above a grocery store. And this is my skid row. And this is where I lived. And this is when all my friends started deserting me. Guys who I'd helped for years and years and years. See me coming down the street, they'd cross the street to avoid me. No one would speak to me anymore. My own family, I come from a family of 10, wouldn't even write to me anymore. I mean, I am absolutely desperate. Now is the time I really need some help. Now is the time I really need some companionship. It was terrible. And I'm lonesome. And I met a gal, and her name was Cecilia. And her husband had just died, and she had a little girl that she was raising. And Cecilia was working her toes off, trying to get money together to keep her and her kid. And she was my buddy, and she was my savior. And she kept me from committing suicide, because I would have done it just as sure as God made green apples. Because I'd had two friends that committed suicide just a little bit before that time, who were alcoholics and had given up. But Cecilia really saved me, because she needed me and I needed her. And we have been married now 42 years, Cecilia and I. And she's a wonderful gal. And our little girl, her little girl, is married and got three kids. And they're doing wonderful. Everybody's great and everybody's just doing fine. And damn it, I'm getting old, so I can't enjoy it as much as I used to. But that's the way it was. And it was bad. And all I was doing was getting pinched for drunk driving. I got pinched so often it wasn't even funny, driving without a license. And I wasn't a bad driver. I never got into any wrecks. I went up the side streets, you know. Real slow, and the cops would get me, and they say, well, they thought that I was casing some joint to rob it, you see, because I was going, and all I was doing was just aiming that old Pontiac with one eye and going up the side street. And I never forget one time that I got pinched on a side street, and they took me over to Georgia Street to test me out how much alcohol I had, you know. That was the damnedest thing I ever saw. I sang myself or laughed myself out of jail that night. But they did. There was a little doctor and two nurses and these two cops there. And they gave me one of those big red balloons, you know. And being a trombone player, I had a hell of a capacity. And I just blew that goddamn balloon way up, you know. And then she slipped and she went brrrr, and hit the floor, see. And I started to laugh. They started laughing. So they hand me another one. We do it again. And everybody is laughing until they're about to cry. And the third time, they're on the floor. I'm laughing, of course, but this time I'm getting pretty sober, too. You're getting all that air done. So the cop turned to the doctor, and he says, "Doc, what do we do with this guy?" And the doctor says, "Take him home and put him to bed." And he says, "This is the greatest vaudeville show we've had here in years." He says, "Please handle him carefully." And by God, they did. One cop drove my car, and the other cop drove it, put me in his car and took me home, parked my car, and let me in my own boarding house as I was staying at that. This is the goddamnest thing I ever saw in my life. This is one of those things. And I got into a lot of trouble. I got into a great deal of trouble all at one time, it seemed, and it looked like I was going to get it good. So I got a phony lawyer, and he said, "For $250, I'll keep you out of jail." I says, "Fine." So I scratched around, and I got $250 together, and I gave it to him. A few days later, he called me up, and he says, "I need another $250. I says, "Why?" He says, "Did you ever see your record down there at the police department?" I says, "No, I never saw my record." He says, "It's awful. You're going to San Quentin." And I says, "You're out of your mind." And he says, "No, I'm not. I need $250 more." So I called up one of my brothers up in North Idaho. Bill's his name. He's passed away now. All my family have passed away but me. I'm the youngest boy of the whole tribe. And Bill had always been my ace in the hole. He'd been like a father to me. In families of 10 kids, you know, one of the older ones kind of take care of the youngers, and Bill took care of me. When I used to get in a jam, Bill would always get me out of it. He was the guy that I could always look to at the last. He was my last resort. So I called up Bill, and I told him the story, and I says, "I might end up in San Quentin." And he says, "If you end up in San Quentin and it keeps you sober, that's the place for you," and he hung up. I said, "My own blood and flesh, my God, what is this business, you know?" So I got 90 days. I got 90 days. They let me out in 45 days, and I says, "I will never drink again. If I ever drink again, I'm going to commit suicide, definitely this time." So I went back to that little room, that $2 a week room, and after about 30 days, something happened. And we alcoholics have this great ability to make mountains out of molehills better than any other class of people in the world. We can take the most minute things, and we can just build them up and build them up and build them up. And to make a mountain out of a molehill is the best description that I have it. And just like all alcoholics, I jumped on a horse and I rode in all directions. I got on my last drunk. And what is this thing called alcoholism? As I understand it, we are allergic to alcohol. 10% of the people in the world are allergic to alcohol in a very strange way. When we take a drink, it causes a compulsion to continue drinking whether we want to or not. And a compulsion is a compelling thing. It overrules self-will. It overrules everything. And we might take three today and say, "Nah, I won't drink anymore," but we're compelled the next day to go back and take that three and many more. And I've tried that many, many times. So this physical thing that we call a compulsion, when we take a drink, is beyond our control, evidently. Now, on the other hand, why did we take that? Well, a lot of times we say, "Why don't you use willpower?" Well, willpower is just another function of the body, another function of the mind. Did you ever stop to think that you use willpower in very, very short spaces of time? You use your willpower to get out of bed in the morning. You don't use your willpower for that purpose anymore. You use your willpower to take a bath or shave or whatever it is, but you don't use your willpower for that purpose anymore. Then you have breakfast, but you don't use your willpower for that purpose anymore. You use your willpower for very, very short spaces of time. Never realized that myself, and I find out that when we say, "I'm going to use my willpower to stay sober," 24 hours a day, 60 minutes to the hour, it's a fallacy. Once in a great while, someone is able to do that on willpower. And one guy that I met in AA had been sober 6 years. And I says, "How'd you do it?" He says, "My wife locked me in my bedroom every night at 6 o'clock. And I stayed sober." Now, the other side of the picture, why do we get drunk? What causes us to take that first drink? We are emotionally instable people. Whether you realize it or not, from the top to the bottom of intelligence, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference how intelligent you are. We are emotional people. Combined with our physical intolerance to alcohol, we are emotional people. And when you look back in your drinking days, you always got drunk when somebody had a birthday. You go to a birthday party, you always got drunk, you know. for celebration, we always got drunk. Somebody got married, we always got drunk. We always got drunk for everything. And then on the other side of the picture, when things were bad, we always got drunk. We always got drunk for some reason. There was always a reason, you see. We might hurt a little bit inside. The only medicine that we knew was to take a drink. Well, unfortunately, having this physical allergy for alcohol, we continued. So, you know, I found something in that program of alcoholics on that fourth step. We find out of all alcoholics have certain defects of character. And these defects of character are the things that usually triggered us off to take that first drink. And I listed these defects of character as close as I could, as honest as I could when I was in AAO1. And I found out that maybe one of the main reasons that I took that first drink and got myself into an emotional spin was self-pity or frustration. And the second worst defect of character that I have are resentments. How many times did I get drunk over resentments? The third worst defect of character is intolerance. And the fourth worst defect of character is selfish. That goes on and on and on and on. And these are the pertinent ideas why I always got myself into a spin. That first drink was all it took, if we can stay away from that first drink. So now, even as of today, when things are getting, I have my downs and my ups. You know, we alcoholics, emotionally, we live a life like the waves in an ocean. We're at the bottom or at the top. Very seldom are we on a steady, who the hell wants to be? Who the hell wants to be emotionally stable anyway? You know, that's silly. We're crazy people. We're having a ball. A lot more fun than we did when we were drinking. So I find out that I can sit down when things are bad and I can look at this list that I made and I can pick it out. You know, the fact that I find it, the reason that I feel as I do today is 90% of the job taken care of. Recognition of why I feel as I do. You can call it self-psychiatry, you can call it anything you want to. Anything that keeps me sober and happy, I'm going to do with it. You know what they used to say years and years ago? If standing on your head in the corner an hour a day keeps you sober, do it. And that's just about the way that I feel about the disease of alcoholism, because if I drink again, I'm dead or I'm in the insane asylum. And you are too, for all that matter. That's the way it is. So anyway, I got on my last drunk. Catty corner from my $2 a week room was a liquor store and a bar. And of course, I set myself up a fine cuff over there because they didn't know me. So at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would be down there drinking, and the bartender was a drunk too. And I'd help him clean out the spittoons and clean out the joint, and I'd sit up on the stool with the shakes and the whips and jingles, and he'd throw one down, and I'd throw it back at him, and after three or four, it'd hook on, and I'd sit there and drink till 11 o'clock, and I'm real good and drunk, and I'd go next door, and I'd cuff for a jug, and I'd climb up those stairs and pass out on my bed. And this was my routine for 8 weeks solid. I dropped 30 pounds. I was out of my mind. I don't remember eating in all that time. Celia says they did everything they possibly could, but they couldn't put me in a hospital in those days. They wouldn't accept you. So here I am, dying, absolutely dying and trying to die. And then I got a call from my old friend, Jack, across town, my old musician friend, March 1st of 1941. And old Jack says, did you see the Saturday Evening Post this week? And I says, no, why? He says, there's an article in there about a group of people in New York called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've stolen our racket. I says, how? He says, well, it shows a picture of a guy lying in bed, and another fellow's looking down at him. And he says, as I understand, this guy brought him some medicine, which is booze, of course, and this guy in bed, when he gets well, and this other fellow's on his can, he goes and helps him. But he says, the amazing thing about it, there's 100 of them. I says, no. He said, yes. I says, like a drunkard's union. He says, exactly. I says, Bob, we better get to New York and find out what's going on. I said, read me the rest of it. He says, I can't. He says, I'm so drunk, my eyes won't focus on that small print. Well, I went on my merry way, and two or three weeks later, he calls me up again. He says, I found this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I says, yeah, what about it? He says, they don't drink. I says, they don't drink. He said, no. Well, I says, tell me about it. Well, he says, I was down at the liquor store cuffing for a jug of wine, and one of the local drunks was paying part of his bill. And I took him outside and I says, what are you paying your bill for? You want to ruin it for the rest of us around this neighborhood? And the guy says, well, I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm making amends. So he says, I went to a meeting with them. They got a chapter here. And he says, I went to a meeting and I haven't had a drink for a week. And I says, oh my God, the worst psychopathic drunk in the world, and you haven't had a drink for a week? I'm a cinch for a lifetime. I says, send the guy over. I want to talk to him. No, he says, you have to call him. So he says, here's his name. Fowler's is the name, and here's his phone number. So So I said, okay, and I called him up. And Fowler says, be over tomorrow afternoon. And I says, oh, don't come in the afternoon. He says, why? I says, I'll be passed out. He says, why will you be passed out? I says, I'm passed out every noon. And if I'm not passed out, I get I have very, very bad times. Very, very bad times. And he says, well, I'll check on it. So about after 3 or 4 days or a week, we finally got together on a Wednesday night. And this Fowler, you know, he started talking about God right away. I said, what's this business? Is this another cult? At that time, there were less than 500 members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States at that time. So I said, well, what is this? I thought it was another cult, another Southern California religion or something, you know. Kept talking about God, talking about God. So we argued. And he said, well, I'll pick you up and take you out down there Friday night. And I said, just a minute. I haven't decided to join this thing of yours yet. I'm going to check it out. I'm not going to lend my name to a bunch of you damn wacky doodles. So he says, okay. And he wrote down the address. Now he says, I'll see you there Friday night. Well, Friday came, and I mean, I'm in a hell of a shape. I'm shaking. I'm spitting cotton. I can't keep anything on my stomach. I'm in a hell of a shape. I'm afraid to get out of the door of that room I had. I finally called up Cecilia, and I says, will you go down with me? And she said, sure. So we went down to that place in 6th Street. And it's just as I told you. When I came to the door, the guy says, do you want to stay sober on an all-time basis? And I says, you betcha. He says, step inside. And I says, I have a sponsor here by the name of Fowler. Is he here? Oh, he says, didn't you hear about Fowler? And I said, no. He said, he got drunk last night. I says, that's wonderful. I didn't like him anyway. So we sat down in the front row. There were a couple empty seats in the front row. And a guy up there starts talking about God and quoting the Bible. And I says, what in hell are we getting into again? This is a Main Street mission. All they need is sawdust on the floor. And I turned to the guy sitting next to me, and I'll never forget his name, Charlie Swearinger. Now, they're all dead, but just three of us of that crowd. So I said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yeah. That's what you call him. And he says, give yourself a break. And stick around for the rest of this meeting and come back to at least 8 meetings. Before you make up your mind, I make a decision. And he says, if you don't like it, go your way. He says, all those guys over there are sober. And he says, I don't know what the hell they're keeping them sober. That's what I'm here to find out myself. So I says, I'll just show you. You challenge an alcoholic, and boy, he picks it up, and I did. So I stayed, thank God. And after the meeting, I met this guy, Pete Cunningham, who lived down in my area. We were the only ones who lived in that area. And old Pete kind of took over. And my God, now I'm sober. Now I'm sober. I get the horn out, and I get myself practicing again, and things are starting to go look good. But I didn't get any work that first year. It was the worst year I ever had. I didn't realize what was going on. I'm really feeling sorry for myself. I call up all the orchestra managers and say, look, Joe, I've been sober 5 months. I mean, give me a break. What's going on? I know you're doing so-and-so pictures. He says, that's wonderful to know that. He says, I'll call you. Don't you call me. And this went on and on and on. It was awful. It was just simply awful. But now I know why. This is all God's will. If I had been able to get back in those studios and start making that heavy sugar again right away, my head would have expanded. The old ego would have come right out, and I'd have been drunk again. Just sure God knew better. It was all God's will. So I had a tough year. And one night I stood up in the group, and I says, I used to make more money when I was drinking. And one of the mean old bastards says, go back to drinking. And I says, I don't want to. He says, okay, sit down and shut up and listen. And then along about this time, I went to the leader of the group. His name was Frank Randall. I says, Frank, do you know anybody in the music business? He said, no, why? And I said, I need a job real bad, and I thought you might have an angle. He says, my boy, this is not an employment agency. This is a place to stay sober. He says, what's your number one problem? I said, alcohol's my number one problem. He said, okay, take care of your number one problem, and everything else will take care of itself when it is supposed to. Not when you want it to, but when it is supposed to. And I said, my God, this is true. This is very, very true. And I think that there hasn't been a day gone by since that time I don't think of that. I got one problem, and that's alcohol. If I take care of that problem, everything else will take care of itself. And I'll get everything in this world that I deserve, and maybe a lot more. Not when I want it, but when I'm supposed to get it. And that's exactly what happened to me in my life, because I had it very, very tough for a few years. But the things started opening up and opening up and opening up. And I got into another line of business, and I made $1 million. And here in 1941, I didn't have 10 cents to scratch against each other. And this is the way God takes care of us. Not the way I want it, but the way it's supposed to be. It's all God's will. Do what I'm supposed to do when I'm supposed to do it, And God will take care of the rest when it's supposed to be done. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is it. We're awful anxious to get things done right today. Oh, we want them done yesterday. But we have to be very patient. We have to have this change in our personality and our attitudes. We're none of us perfect. Well, none of us come right out here and be Mr. Bill Wilson, and he wasn't perfect by a hell of a lot. We argued all the time. And Bill argued with me because he wanted to get ideas, I guess. My wife and I were visiting with Bill Wilson and his wife up at their home. Celia says, "Now, don't you argue with him." She says, "I'm not going out there tonight. I'm not going out there for the weekend unless you promise you won't argue with him." I says, "Okay." Bill says, "What's the matter with you? You're not arguing tonight." So we didn't. It was really wonderful. Now, I was among the musicians all the time, of course, and getting into Alcoholics Anonymous and meeting people who were not of the musicians was a real education to me, too, I'll tell you that, because all I had was musicians talk. But there was a little guy by the name of Fidgie McGrath who played piano on CBS radio, and he was a fantastic little guy, and we all loved him. He stood about 5'6", he had fat, pudgy hands, and he played piano like an angel, just like an angel. Fidgie had a nice family. He lived in Santa Monica, had a nice home, a couple of kids, a couple of cars, a nice wife, and everything. We loved the guy. He was making about $500 a week then, which was awful big money. And old Fidgie started drinking. And it seemed in no time at all, old Fidgie was a full-blown alcoholic. Of course, he lost his job. His wife divorced him, and here he is playing these piano bars. Owns nothing but a couple stiff shirts and a tuxedo, and this is it. And he's playing these piano bars for $50 a week in tips. And he got a job away out on the south side at a beautiful piano bar, and he went out there and to chase the whole neighborhood and the whole thing. He had to get himself a room out there. So he found himself a room, and he came back to the piano bar and chased the whole thing again. And he found from the piano bar over to his room he could take a shortcut through a very little cemetery, a winding path. So every morning at 2 o'clock when he gets through work, he's usually drunk as a goat, and he follows this path through the cemetery, and he's home in 10 minutes, never got into trouble. Beautiful, beautiful deal. But this particular morning, Fidgie is awfully drunk. And he starts, and it's raining, and it's cold. And he starts through the cemetery, and he got off this winding path, and he fell in a hole that was dug for a funeral the next day. And here's the poor little bastard at the bottom of that hole. He's so short he can't reach the top of the hole to get out, and he's screaming like a Comanche all night long. And about dawn, an old wino come wandering through the cemetery. And he hears this screaming and hollering, and he wandered around, and he finally found little Fidgie at the bottom of the hole. He had given up. He was spread-eagled out, laying on his back like this, tuxedo on and the whole deal. And this wino looked down at him, and he says, "What's the matter down there?" And Fidgie says, "Get me out of here. I'm freezing to death. Get me out of here. I'm freezing to death." And the wino looked at him a minute. He says, "Well, no wonder you're freezing to death. You've kicked all your dirt off." Fidgie was known by all of us pretty well, and we all used to all hang out at the grotto, the Melrose Grotto, right in the middle of Hollywood. And Friday afternoons, about 4 o'clock, you'd find all we freelance musicians at these stools in this long bar. And old John was the bartender, and he knew us, and we knew him. And this particular Friday afternoon, why, the guy sitting next to me nudged me with his elbow, and he says, "Look, coming through the door, and here comes Fidgie. My God, he looked like death warmed over." He was all puked all over himself. His clothes were all torn. His whiskers were down to here. He was an awful mess. And he came over and he pulled himself up on this vacant stool and he beat on the bar and he says, "Bartender, John, bartender, give me a drink. You know, John, I'm the best damn piano player in the world. I can play anything. Just give me a drink." Finally, one of the musicians was a little intolerant and he says, "There's a piano over there, Fidgie. Let's hear you play anything." So Fidgie says, "I'll just show you." So he slid off the bar and he started for the piano, and my God, when he turned around, his pants were... The seat of his pants were out and his ass was hanging out. And the bartender saw this and he ran around to the end of the bar just as Fidgie sat down. And he says, "Do you know your ass is hanging out?" And Fidgie says, "No, but you just sing a few bars and I'll follow you." That's a good old musician's joke. Wonderful days, wonderful days. We get back to the program now and get a little sensible. go down the steps, we get down to the 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual awakening, and I've spoken about the spiritual a lot of times. The whole program is spiritual. Alcoholics Anonymous is spiritual. There's no sides to this thing. There's no spiritual side. And you were looking at the book, page 569, the last chapter in the book. I wrote that last paragraph in there because Bill made a bad mistake. You know, I had to straighten him out. He had a spiritual side of the program. And I called his attention to it, and he says, it'll be changed right away, which he did. He listened to me. So, anyway, I asked Bill Wilson, I says, what do you mean by the spiritual business in here, having had a spiritual awakening? Well, he says, honest to goodness, the spiritual awakening is a change in our personalities. And it says in this chapter, with this, it's a page and a half, he says, our friends and our family notice long before we realize there's been a definite change in our personality. And this is the true spiritual awakening. And that's what it is. So you see, everything about Alcoholics Anonymous is common sense. It's all down to earth. It's not pie in the sky. It's not hallelujah. We change our attitudes. The stinking thinking caused our drinking. We change that. We get ourselves straightened up, and we're starting to be human beings again. But we don't drink. We don't drink. Probably no human power could help us that God could and would have sought. Action is the magic word. To reach the help of God, we must try to the best of our ability to live these spiritual steps. And God helps those who help themselves. And I'll tell you a little story to close. A little boy, 4 years old, became completely blind. His family took him everywhere. They were quite well fixed, and they took him everywhere to the great eye specialists and eye surgeons. And no one was able to diagnose why he couldn't see. So the boy went through life totally blind until he had graduated from college. And here he is, a big strapping kid, 24 years old, very brilliant, totally blind. And a young doctor moved into this city where they lived, and he was an eye specialist and an eye surgeon, an ophthalmologist. And a lot of their friends went to this man, and he helped them a great deal with their eye trouble. So the boy went. And the doctor says, from what you tell me, it'll take me some time to diagnose why you can't see. So he went back to this doctor many times for examinations, and finally the doctor says, I think I have the proper diagnosis, but it'll mean an operation. And the boy says, let's go. So they went to the hospital. The next day he operated on this boy, and he laid up on this bed in the hospital perfectly quiet for 23 days with bandages over his eyes. On the 23rd day, the doctor called up the family, and he says, tomorrow we will find out whether this operation was a success or not. And here's the whole family standing around the bed. The doctor slowly took these bandages off the boy's eyes. And when he got them completely off his eyes, the boy opened his eyes, and my God, he could see light. And then he could recognize his family, and he grabbed the doctor by the hand. He says, doctor, I don't know how to thank you. I just don't know how to thank you. And the doctor says, don't thank me. All I did was put in the stitches, and God took care of the rest. And all we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is put in the stitches, and God takes care of the rest. Be good to yourself, and God bless you.